well, OpenAI have denied any intentional resemblance, even though they originally reached out to Scarlett Johansson and tried to persuade her to allow them to use her voice, and they've since removed that voice from Sky. But it does raise questions, lots of them, about where we may be headed with artificial intelligence. I'm joined by Professor Jacob Forster, who leads the Forster Lab for AI Research at Oxford University. Connor Leahy is CEO of Conjecture AI, which focuses on controllable, safe developments of advanced AI technology. And Kester Bruin, whose new book is titled Godlike, a 500-year history of artificial intelligence in myths, machines, and monsters. And Kester, welcome to all of you, first of all. But Kester, let me come to you first on this. Myths, machines, and monsters. Where do you place AI in the history of human imagination and our interaction with the world?
I mean, it's thanks for having me on, William, and really, really great to be here. It's an extraordinary invention and perhaps one of the greatest things that we have ever done as a species. But just like the atomic bomb, it's been created in order to do great good. And I tell the story in the book of how actually in the invention of the atomic bomb, one of the people behind that then writes an article for Atlantic magazine saying, hey, look, we've done all this work, you know, building weapons of war to win the war. We've now got to do something to build a weapon of peace. And that's actually one of the founding moments of AI, because one of the people who reads that article in Atlantic magazine in 1945 goes on to kind of lead that kind of human computer interaction stuff. So it ranks very, very highly. But as with all technologies, they amplify our abilities, but then ask us very deep questions. And AI is such an amplifying technology that the questions it is asking us as a species are very, very deep indeed.
And the worry, Jacob, that many people have is it's also going to replace us in the way that blacksmiths were replaced by car manufacturers. Is that a real worry for you?
I mean, to be honest, I think the idea that we'll all be out of jobs, I don't see it as a huge risk. I think to me, primarily, this is a question of how do we allocate resources and how do we redistribute our resources as society. Obviously, the sort of utility of different qualifications will change and has always changed over the Industrial Revolution and thereafter. So to me, this is mostly a political and social problem rather than one of technology at this point.
Connor, what are you worried about with AI?
Well, I see quite pragmatically, if we build systems that are as smart or smarter than humans, that means better at business, politics, science, deception, and everything else, and we don't know how to control them, which we currently don't know how to do, well, what do you think happens?
Well, you think they'll control us?
I think they will outcompete us very, very rapidly and be able to control us. If I have systems that are better at persuasion, they never get tired, they never have to rest, they never get distracted, they have no emotions. You know, of course, they're computer programs. Why would they have emotions? And they're set to maximize profit because, of course, they're being built by profit-seeking companies. And those systems get deployed. Well, I think they will do exactly what they're designed to do.
This is the worry that lots of people have, Kester, that maybe for the first time in human history, we have created something that is vastly more intelligent than us, that is vastly more intellectually agile than us, and which has the capacity for independence.
Yeah, and it's you know, we have to remember that it is a human creation, but whenever we create things, it changes our relationship with one another as well. And you mentioned before, the story of the Horizon scandal. That is a story about technology that made people treat one another very poorly. It is a very good example of how people trusted a system rather than trusted their relationships with one another. So the key thing about our response to AI is that we need to be much better reflective users of technology. We've got that wrong with the rise of social media, and we haven't even begun to see the impact with kind of AI-generated content, which will be exactly focused on all of your buttons that the algorithm knows about you, William. So we've got to be much better at being reflective users of technology in order to safeguard how we actually begin to use this technology. We're not currently doing that, and that is a real worry.
And Connor, that is a real worry because we haven't been able to properly regulate the internet. What makes anybody think we could regulate AI?
I think this is the exact question, is whenever I see people just assume that AI will go well, I ask where that confidence is coming from. We've already messed up pretty dramatically on almost every other technology when it was first invented. And with AI emerging at, you know, exponentially fast rates, you know, we don't have time to, like, you know, have a couple generations fail and then catch up with it. But these systems, especially once they, you know, are as smart as humans, it also means they can build better AI systems by definition, right? Once you have a smart AI system that knows how to program, you can make better AIs. Well, if you have a better AI, that can make an even better AI. And the even better AI, and so on and so forth. So all of this can happen extremely rapidly. And as we know, our governments, our institutions, our culture, as I just said, is already struggling to catch up with social media, which is almost 20 years old at this point.
And Jacob, this, I don't think it's an overstatement to say this may be the greatest experiment in the history, is in the history of humanity. You think of Sam Altman 10 years ago, the boss of OpenAI said 10 years ago, it would be incredibly dangerous to release generative AI when it was then being thought about in the future. We have it now. To release it into large language models and to give it any semblance of independence without any kind of regulation, that is precisely what he ended up doing.
I think this is something quite important, and I'm sorry I tried to make that point early in the conversation. The idea that OpenAI is still pursuing its mission that it once set out to pursue is ludicrous. I think we've seen sort of like a worst case here where we've gone from a company that's claiming to do the thing that is right, produce AI for everyone, to then becoming a profit maximizer.
Yeah.
And that was touched upon before in the conversation. I think that's what I see as the biggest risk, that it's a tool that's extremely powerful that is not being used for the good of the general public. And I think the only way out of this is to strengthen the academic sector in the field of AI and make sure that open source tools that can be used by everyone to actually work towards the common good, strengthen our institutions, give these skills to our public institutions and our regulators, as well as the profit-seeking companies. Mm-hmm. I see it's the only way to stabilize not societies, but also make sure that humanity will continue to exist.
Kester, one wonders if that horse has bolted. This generative AI phenomenon is now in the hands of unregulated capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, it has been very difficult. We saw that the AI Safety Summit that the UK hosted sort of 6 months ago in November, and that called for a pause and for these new models to be tested by you know, different government regimes. And that pause has not happened. And, the reason for that is basically because people are trying to get the capital out of it. The reason I called the book Godlike, by the way, is not because that's my term. The UK's own lead on AI safety, Ian Hogarth, wrote an article for the FT a year ago saying we must pause the race to godlike AI. So people are thinking about this technology in terms of that kind of, theological transcendent context. And that must be a reason that calls us to think, hold on a second, you know, we do need to pause for thought here before we go too far with it.
I'm not sure the public is generally thinking in these terms. I'm not sure the public, Connor, fully grasps. It's difficult for me at times to fully grasp the real potential of AI, not just as a technology, but as something that could change the human experience in a way that has never been seen before in the history of our species.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're used to being alone on the planet. We're used to being the smartest, you know, civilization on the planet. There never really was a time when that was not true. All of our assumptions are based on this being true. If this is no longer true, that changes, well, everything.
It does.
Like, one of the things I think is very important to understand is, you know, we can argue about, will AI, you know, advance this fast or that fast? Will it replace this job or that job? Sure, we can argue about this. But fundamentally, we all have to face that nothing will go back to normal. If this is done, if people build AI that is as smart as humans or smarter, there is no going back. Everything will change forever. And this is a massive risk which is being imposed upon society as an experiment by unelected, unaccountable, unregulated business people with no accountability to anyone, yeah. As a journalist has called them. Maybe a bunch of capitalist, childless Buddhists don't have the correct level of risk, sensitivity to be running experience like this on the general public.
We're going to stay across it. Maybe we should just get you all guys back again at some point. We'll explore it in more detail. Fascinating. I'm absolutely fascinated by it. I'm not sure the world really knows what is happening to it at this point, but our thanks to Kester Bruin, the author of Godlike, A 500-Year History of the Artificial Intelligence in Myths, Machines, and Monsters, Professor Jacob Forster, and Connor Leahy. It's 1 o'clock.